I'll do it.
They were.
Okay. Is it Bill? You had a question.
I guess it was a question that also relates to pastoral problems. And that is the problem of bringing the people's awareness to the point that there is a problem. And you said that they seem to be asking common sense questions, which are not necessarily the other questions. We always seem to be locked into that same sort of thing, or, you know, we're always working from the other side of that chasm, and they're never understanding the gap. And I suppose my experience this weekend was maybe closing that gap and dealing with this on the level of, as you said, those concerns that are what. Alienation. Well, that's one of the questions. my question is, how is that gap closed? I suppose that's essentially what you're answering.
It is only on the level of those most vital concerns that the gap between the public consciousness and what I would call the genuine question, the genuine path, what that gap is closed. It's only at the level of the most vital questions. That can be done. Those vital questions are all the questions that are involved in the various limit situations of human existence. Alienation is but one. Guilt, death, suffering, negative. Also, you know, intense joy and love and so on. Too many people, when they talk of the limit situations, talk only of the negative. There are also, in addition to anxiety, we do experience positive things as well, which stretch us to the limit of our being. Now, it's only in touch with those dimensions that the gap between the public consciousness and the genuine path of life. So I think that the preacher, to bring it right down to pastoral concerns, the preacher has got to be continually touching those limit situations. And in the midst of bringing alive in people the awareness of the limit situations, beginning to talk about the path that can be found through negotiation of those limit situations. The path that you believe that you can be open in the midst of those limit situations. Difficulty is that in our public consciousness, and I think that this is cannot be said with the same generality of a lot of other cultural situations in the past and perhaps in the present as well. The ability to touch and speak about publicly these most basic situations we are removed from the most basic truth about our existence in a way that makes that most basic truth not as publicly available as it is to people, as it has been to people in those other cultures. And cultures, including cultures that we consider in our false superiority to the primitive cultures. There is a sense of participation in the greater reality, and a sense of the wonder of those limited situations that we have lost. Watch, as I had the privilege in this summer, just once, a Native American culture dealing with grieving and death. And you know how much in tune they are with any other questions? Have I please, if I'm, you know, I know this stuff is heavy. Yes.
Just in my own understanding, are we saying that if we ask the question, what is the meaning of existence, or that kind of question, that could be appropriately raised, and that if through a process of genuineness, that we would trust that there isn't a foundational answer to that question, that is going to involve what we as Christians would accept as our foundation of our faith. And so we accept all this as a sure thing.
I do. But, you know, I mean, that's at the end of a process.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I'm stating something that is my worldview at the age of 41. You know, I couldn't have said that at 25. And I'm stating it in a way just so that you know where I'm coming from. Some of the groundwork for these conclusions will be spelled out.
Are we saying also that if you trust the individual, that ultimately the individual will find it?
I am saying that the open dynamic process of raising and answering questions in the ongoing course of the movement of life will lead to eternity.
So that is our problem. I know you're not dealing with our problem that there is raising questions.
Our problem is that the question itself is dead.
We raise the question, people will find the answer.
You have to raise the question before what you claim as a Christian to be the answer to make it sound there. The person's consciousness is dead. The question is dead, and the person's consciousness, the answer makes no sense.
So we need a fair energy to raise the question.
Oh, you can also, once the question is alive, you can also offer it. You can also offer what you have discovered in response to the question. But if the question is dead, the person doesn't even know it's a problem, then the answer makes no sense. Vogelin's paper, The Gospel and Culture, first of all, shows how the question was alive in Greek culture. When Christianity moved out of Palestine, preaching the death and resurrection of Jesus as salvation, the question was already alive in the culture, and so the gospel could be preached directly to the consciousness that was already awake. And then he goes into his interpretation of the modern cultural experience, where the very question is dead, and states that the preaching of the gospel depends upon reason.
We are saying then that we accept ultimately the death of this question is not a positive thing. Then why did it happen?
Well, the fascination, I think, with the power, one aspect of why it happened. The fascination with the power that is given by the development of modern scientific methods, which itself is a positive thing. The development of modern scientific methods is a positive thing. It has led to an understanding of reality that was not available before those methods were developed. But the power that those methods has given, and the fascination with that power, which is present in the writings of the people first intimated what scientific method was all about, Francis Bacon, Descartes, people who first had some kind of intimation of what a mathematical understanding of physical reality could do. That fascination with the power that it could give is already present in their writings. And I think part of the depth of the question is the fascination with power. Part of it is the fascination with the power over reality that we are given by knowledge, by scientific knowledge. Knowledge has always been power. The problem has been dealing with the power that knowledge gives. So I would go to that as at least one dimension of the answer to the question that you raise. Nietzsche's whole anticipation of the centuries that were to follow him, where the will to power and the creation of the Übermensch, the superhuman being, would be the dominant dimension of the cultural ethos, is prophetic. But it is also, as Heidegger has pointed out, it is also the ultimate nihilism. The ultimate nihilistic position. Everything else is reduced to a subordinate status in reference to the public.
This, as a phenomenon, seems to rise and fall, come and go, certainly in modern history. In relation to the types of crises, world crises, national, international crises that are taking place, and when there is a threat to national security, the limits of knowledge and competence and power, there seems to be a reversion to the basic questions. A rising awareness of these basic questions.
Hmm. I have yet to see any sustained pursuit of those basic questions. There's a reversion to them when something happens, but a sustained pursuit of them, I don't see it as I see it in individuals. I don't see it as a culturally acceptable thing.
I was saying this in the light of maybe present circumstances, a rising level of anxiety because of social, political, economic situation right now.
Okay, there's two things that can happen out of that rising anxiety. You know, one of them is despair.
Mm-hmm.
Is give up. And the other one is raising and answering questions. It can go either way, and I see as much evidence of the first as I do the second, but not more. At the practical, ordinary, everyday living, level of ordinary living, you know, I just see the surrender, the renunciation of the possibility of truth and value. And at the superstructural level of scientific reflection on humanity, structuralism, are you familiar at all with the French structuralism, is the ultimate example of this. They are declaring scientifically the death of humanity and the end of history. That's so scientific, reflective, sophisticated statement of capturing, I think, the despair that is in the public arena.
Of course, this is happening at one end of the Christian community too. Hyper negative aspect of
what do you
end timeism, you might say.
What, yeah, apocalyptic sort of.
Yeah.
And there's two senses of apocalyptic as well. You know, one is, you know, the curtain is over, the curtain is falling. And the other one is, this is the kairos for a whole new development. And this is my point. This is what I want. This is the opportune time for a radical new development in the history of consciousness.
Yeah, the key word there.
Now that's
is
an apocalyptic statement, but it's not. You know, it's curtains necessarily and inevitably. It could well be, but it's not.
Right. But I see the key word there is opportunity.
Yeah.
An interesting resistance to your approach last year. I took a course from Tad Dunn, and von Lonergan in this, the switch to interiority that he's talking about, starting from the subject. Well, I applied some of that stuff in an essay I handed in on from Trinity to the Aquinas people. And, you know, the levels and the way we can start with our own experience. The criticisms were all, this is just more of the me generation stuff, navel gazing. That's the way they're going to just not even look at that surface. And that's, you know, that's one way of blocking the whole thing out of any possibility whatsoever.
See, the model that is present in Lonergan, which would be the response to that objection, the model of the authentic subject is self-transcendence, not self-fulfillment. That's the thing of the me generation, the culture of narcissism. Self-fulfillment is your ultimate value when you get with respect to the subject. The authentic subject is not the one who walks around always feeling self-fulfilled. The authentic subject is the one who freely is performing those operations that lead that subject beyond himself. That's the authentic subject. The one who freely and consistently is capable of operations that transcend himself. And that gives the lie to the whole objection of the me generation. If by interiority analysis you arrive at a further degree of self-transcendence, then it's not the me generation at all.
That's always going to be there, aren't
you? Sure. Okay, now to move into precisely that, the structure of Christian consciousness. I want to give you here my answer to the first of those four questions that I raised. How does, well really the first and the second, how does the human psyche participate in and affect the spiritual life, and how does the pursuit of the spiritual life affect and change the movements and states of the human psyche? Those first two questions, I'm going to begin to state my own response to them right now. Let me ask you, first of all, would you prefer the window open or closed? Open, you get more noise but less air. Can you hear me in the back? Can you hear? I'll leave it for you. Okay. What I am intending with this whole Roman numeral 2 is to suggest some exercises in self-appropriation. I cannot appropriate you, your consciousness. Only you can do it. All I can do is suggest some exercises that some of them you can follow me in the lecture, and I can bring you through some of those. But others, and particularly those that deal with your affective self-appropriation, I can't do that, and I can't do that here. But to suggest some exercises in self-appropriation. All right. Now, I called this section the structure of Christian consciousness. I'm really dealing with what I believe is the structure of consciousness in general. I call Christian consciousness here because I believe that certain dimensions of that structure become clear only through revelation. They are dimensions of that structure which are operative with or without explicit revelation, but they become clarified only through the revelation of God in Christ. But this structure is the structure of human consciousness in general. I'm taking a lot of what I say from Lonergan, but I'm not presupposing that you know him already. I will be adding some of my own material, too, as I go along. And I will be using a distinction that Lonergan makes only in a very late work, that paper that I mentioned in the last class, Healing and Creating in History, which I recommend that you read. It is not a difficult paper. Namely, the distinction between two vectors in human consciousness. Okay. So, first of all, the creative vector in human consciousness. When I speak about two vectors in human consciousness, I'm saying that there is a movement in our consciousness from below upwards, and another movement in human consciousness from above downwards. These are spatial metaphors
consciousness is really not a spatial thing. You can't see it. Open your eyes and there's consciousness standing before you, the upper and lower. They're metaphors. But we have to have some kind of figurative way of speaking about what we cannot see. And the level, the metaphor of level is as good as any, I think. So there is a movement in consciousness from below upwards, and that is the creative vector in human consciousness. And there is a movement in consciousness from above downwards, and that is the healing vector in human consciousness. Let's talk first of all about the creative vector, because that's where we find the need for the healing vector. It's a breakdown of the creative vector. This distinction, for those of you who were at Walter Kasper's talk last week, is not irrelevant to a discussion of Christology from below and Christology from above, but I'm not going to get into all of that. Okay. So first of all, then, the creative vector in human consciousness from below upwards. First sort of thing in terms of going through an exercise in self-appropriation. If you are listening to what I am saying and hearing it, and the noises are coming in, but there is no clue as to what I'm talking about. Nothing's going on. And there's not even a question. What in the world is he talking about? You are conscious, but you are operating at only at the level of consciousness that I will call, following Lonergan, empirical consciousness. The noises are coming in, but I might as well be talking Japanese or anything else. And as far as anything else is concerned, there is no organization of the noises into a coherent whole. Your consciousness resembles that of an animal, of a lower animal, in hearing these words. There's nothing else that is happening, but you are conscious. The empirical level of consciousness is operative. You are not, I hope, in a dreamless sleep. Not that bad. Whenever we are not in a dreamless sleep or a coma, at least empirical consciousness is operative. Even dreams are conscious. Dreams are not part of the unconscious. If they were, we could not remember them. Dreams are conscious experiences. So, the empirical level of consciousness is operative whenever the human person is not in a dreamless sleep or a coma. There are impressions that are being registered at the sensory level. Now, if in addition to hearing the words that I'm speaking, you are also attempting to understand what I'm saying, your consciousness is operating at both the empirical level and the intelligent level. For your consciousness to be operating at the intelligent level, you don't have to understand what I'm talking about. You have to be attempting to understand. That's sufficient for the level of intelligent consciousness to be operative. The attempt to understand. The question. The desire for intelligibility. Intelligence is awake and alive. The empirical level is not obliterated by the intelligent level. You're still hearing what I'm saying. The empirical level is lifted up by the intelligent level, or the technical term, sublated. You don't have to remember that. The technical term is sublated. Both levels are operative. The empirical and the intelligent are both operative. If you are attempting to understand or are actually understanding what I'm talking about. But even the very attempt to understand is sufficient to say that intelligence is operative, your consciousness is operating intelligently, not just empirically, but also intelligently. If you think that you are understanding what I'm talking about, and are asking the further question, is it right? Then there's yet another level of your consciousness that is awake and alive, and we'll call that the rational level. I understand what you're saying, but I'm trying to figure out whether it's correct or not. Is it so? Is this really true? If that question's alive, then your consciousness at one and the same time is working empirically, intelligently, and rationally. These are the ways in which I'm using those terms. Empirically, intelligently, and rationally. All three dimensions are alive and awake and operative. Now, at certain points in our experience, we come to the judgment, yes, this is the case. And a further question arises, what am I going to do about it? And at that point, there's still another level of your consciousness that is working, and that is the existential, or the moral, or the decisional level of human consciousness, where the question becomes one of deliberation about action. Having judged that something is true, that judgment prompts you to move to a decision. And at that point, the fourth level of your consciousness, the existential, the moral, or the decisional level, is alive. And again, it is enough for the question to be raised, for that level of consciousness to be operating. You don't have to have arrived at the decision. You have to be at least pursuing the decision. You have to be asking the question, what am I going to do about it? If that question is awake and alive, then you are operating at all four levels of consciousness. They're all working. Now, there are certain figures in the history of human thought about human experience who have pointed to, I should have started a little lower, a fifth level of consciousness. St. Augustine says, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." There is, in this creative movement from below upwards, the seeking of the ultimate, the seeking of God, the finding of God. That occurs because we are intelligent, we are rational, we are existential, but it's a different level of experience. It sublates all of those into the experience of the ultimate, of seeking the ultimate and finding the ultimate. The fifth level of consciousness is the level of grace, the level of the supernatural, if you want. The level on which we are explicitly seeking and finding God. Craig?
Just a question about the difference between the fifth and the fourth.